You have it. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning again. May it please the court. My name is Lauren Whitley on behalf of Mr. Dodson. On the evening of May 18, 2016, Bernard Lee Dodson was coming back from buying a fish sandwich in the city of Richmond. He was on the corner of Brooklyn Park and Haines Avenue on the south side. He ran into a friend, and they were having a conversation. Two police officers drove by in their police vehicle and asked Mr. Dodson about the contents of his pocket, his fish sandwich. Mr. Dodson refused to answer. He had a seat. His arms were placed in front of that pocket. The officers exited their vehicles. They approached him on either side. They were in uniform with their firearms, with their bully sticks, and proceeded to ask him on five different occasions what was in his pocket. Mr. Dodson firmly but politely refused to tell them.
Let me fast forward here.
Sure.
In your narrative. When they told him they were going to search him, and he reacted by striking the police officer and resisting the search, did the police at that point have probable cause to believe he committed a crime?
Well, I would argue at the point, and I think there's two interactions that the video shows and the officers testified to. There's the moment when one of the officers says, "I'm going to touch it," and reaches for the pocket. It's hard to see on the video because it doesn't fully cover it, but they testified at that time that Mr. Dodson made a motion and made contact with the officer's hand, pushing it away. At that point, I would argue that was not an assault and there was not probable cause to arrest him. Because at that point,
but
Mr.
Didn't he hit him as he flailed about?
Well, at that point, the officers then grabbed his arms. One grabbed his forearm, the other grabbed his other arm. He was standing up, and they kind of, it's hard to tell, but their testimony was he stood up. And he proceeded to resist the unlawful assault of his person at that point.
So we now have probable cause that he committed a felony.
That was the argument of the police officers, and that was what the trial court found. Our position is at that point, he was defending his person. He was, as he is lawfully able to do in Virginia, resisting that unlawful arrest.
That's the next area that I wanted to move to.
Sure.
And I understand, I'm not trying to get you to concede something, but let's assume for purposes of this argument that the police did have probable cause at that point that he committed a felony. The right to resist an unlawful arrest, assuming that that's what this is a defense to an assault on the officer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to show that concept eliminates probable cause or negates probable cause?
No, I don't have any cases to establish that, but I think that there is some discussion one of the federal cases that I cited, United States against Bailey, about the interplay of that right to resist an unlawful arrest as far as it applies in the context of the attenuation doctrine itself. So, because what we're really dealing with here is the trial court determined that Mr. Dodson's actions, which we're arguing as lawful, in resisting that unlawful arrest, severed the unconstitutional government conduct from the narcotics evidence that was found on his person later on. What we're saying is that right to resist that arrest is one of the factors that shows that it did not sever the unconstitutional conduct from the evidence that was found. Maybe I misunderstood, Your Honor.
No, I think we're on the same page. It seems to me that you'd have a very good argument if he'd not committed a new offense, if he had stood up and submitted to the officer's demand to be searched. I think you might have a valid argument. But I don't see how an individual can be permitted to commit a felony offense and establish probable cause for an arrest for that offense, and then rely on the fact that at some later date he might be able to defeat the assault on the police officer charge at trial.
And I'm not sure, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just want to make sure I understand the court's question.
I mean, right to resist unlawful arrest is a defense. It's a species of self-defense,
right,
that you can use to defeat the assault charge.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with whether the officer had probable cause in the first instance to believe that a crime occurred.
Well, I think in the context of this analysis, Your Honor, it's related to those three factors under the attenuation doctrine. So I'm not sure that it putting aside in kind of a vacuum in isolation, that it would defeat probable cause to arrest. Certainly, as you can be arrested for murder and then raise self-defense later at trial, right? But I think here what we're talking about is we're looking at temporal proximity. We're looking at the circumstances of the new and intervening crime here, which they're alleging was Mr. Dodson's defense of his person and the assault that occurred. And then finally, we're looking at the flagrancy of the police misconduct. So all of those, particularly the last two factors, are directly related to whether or not he had the right in Virginia to protect his person, to defend himself. Because we're looking at the circumstances as they arose.
Can I ask you on that, Ms. Sure. Whitley? Because certainly in Virginia, we have a common law right for self-defense for an unlawful arrest.
Right.
But at this point, I mean, the officer's conduct is certainly questionable here.
Right.
But at this point, it doesn't appear they were arresting him. It seems they were detaining him to do essentially a Terry stop. And doesn't the case law say that there is no right to physically resist a sort of Terry stop detention as opposed to an unlawful arrest?
Whether that Terry stop is proper or improper.
Sure. Right. Yeah, there is. Our argument, though, is that the point the officers placed physical hands on him, we are way past a Terry stop. That is the arrest.
Wait a minute. That's a concept that's developed in the context of escape. The concept of laying of hands on the individual is necessary in order for there to be an arrest, in order for there to be an escape from that arrest. But a police officer is entitled to lay hands on an individual in order to facilitate a reasonable suspicion pat-down, aren't they?
The restraint of liberty is only permitted under a Terry stop seizure in Virginia when it is reasonable. So I would point this court to Thomas against Commonwealth. In that case, the individual was approached, a single officer approaches individual suspected of sexual assault at night by himself, places the suspect in handcuffs to conduct a show-up identification. This court, I believe it was this court's case, said that was permitted, a total restraint of liberty, even though it was still a Terry stop, because of the danger to the officer. We do not have those circumstances here. Mr. Dodson is not aggressive. I dispute the Commonwealth's characterization of him as belligerent. He is firm and polite with the officers in asserting his Fourth Amendment rights.
But he refused to obey the command. He did.
He asserted his Fourth Amendment right to not tell them what was in his pocket.
Would you agree that he became belligerent as soon as they went to touch that pocket?
I think at the time, our argument is the time they assaulted him and put hands on him, he resisted that assault. So I think that at that point, there was a physical interaction.
Now, the right to resist an unlawful arrest, to kind of follow up on what Judge Beals was asking you, is separate and apart from an unlawful seizure, isn't it? There is no right to
yes.
resist an unlawful
yes.
seizure, is there?
No, there's not. Not in Virginia. That's correct.
So, does it cause a big problem for you if this court were to believe that at the time they went to lay hands on him to conduct this frisk, that maybe they had seized him, but they certainly hadn't arrested him?
No, because we're still talking about that conduct of Mr. Dodson interrupting the flow of the unconstitutional conduct and the evidence that was found. The question before this court is still, was the evidence seized as a result of exploiting that unconstitutional government conduct? So even if this court, and we're not going to concede that fact, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Just even if this court were to find that the laying on of hands was a seizure and not an arrest, it still then has to find that the new and intervening circumstance and the flagrancy of the conduct is on the side of the Commonwealth. And we argue that it is not, because it flows and is arising in the midst of the unconstitutional government conduct.
The officer didn't exploit anything. The defendant chose to resist and to commit an assault on the police officer. That was the defendant's doing, not the police officer's doing.
But when we're talking about flagrancy of conduct, we do have to look at what the police are responding to. So I would answer by saying at that point, the police have no indication a crime has occurred. They don't know Mr. Dodson. Unlike the case I argued earlier, they don't know him to be a felon. They don't ask for his identification to go look him up in the system to see if he has a warrant, if he is a felon, if he has a concealed weapons permit. So we're talking about a situation that the officers have no reason to be detaining him in order to further investigate.
I mean, they don't even really indicate that they feel they need to do a frisk for officer safety.
Right. No, I don't think they feel in danger.
So basically, I guess, The question I have is, we have case law that says during a Terry stop, you can even be handcuffed without it being an arrest.
Right.
So why, if you can be handcuffed without it necessarily being an arrest, and here they're just putting their hands on him to get him to stand up, because he said he wasn't going to stand up either.
Right.
And to feel the bulge in the pocket. And then he resists by elbowing the officer in the face and actually knocks the body cam off so you can't see anything. Well, I've looked at the tape twice.
Right.
But I don't understand your argument as to why, if it's just, if it's not a full-fledged arrest at that point, it's just a Terry detention, how he had the right at that point to do that to the officers, and then at that point there is a crime, so you have a search incident to arrest.
And I guess there's kind of two aspects to that. First is, we would say that you do have the right to restrain someone's liberty under a Terry stop in Virginia, but that full restraint has to be reasonable under the circumstances. And our argument here is that it was unreasonable, because these officers outnumbered Mr. Dotson. They were not scared of him. There was no threatening motions. And that takes this outside of the cases like Thomas, where the officer is by himself at night, recent sexual assault, puts the individual in handcuffs. So we would argue that it is an arrest for that reason. But even if this court finds that it's a detention, as far as the officers are concerned, this court still has to, and the second layer of it, I apologize, is the aspect of whether we're talking about evidence of an ongoing criminal offense or evidence of the new crime. And we're not conceding that evidence of the new crime would necessarily come in, but in cases such as Fultz and the city of Danville, what Virginia courts ultimately held is, okay, so evidence of the new crime might be admissible. So evidence of the assault on the police officer or evidence of obstruction of justice. But because these officers were exploiting their unconstitutional conduct in discovering the narcotics evidence, that evidence should be suppressed. And that's what we're arguing. Fultz and the city of Danville don't say that. They talk about the new crimes evidence.
Let me ask you about a kind of a procedural issue here that I have some concern with. This was a conditional guilty plea.
It was.
And there were two charges he pled guilty to. One was felony obstruction of justice, and the other was possession of the drugs.
Right.
Although the obstruction of justice is appealed, he has effectively pled guilty to that, which is a judicial admission that he was guilty. Now, if we have that judicial admission of guilt, we surely must have probable cause. And that's Neff versus Commonwealth. You know, in Neff, the defendant was arrested for drunk in public, and he assaulted the police officers when they tried to arrest him. He claimed that there was a right to resist an unlawful arrest because he wasn't in public. And we said, wait a minute, he was convicted of drunk in public. How can you now say that they didn't have probable cause that he was drunk in public?
And, Your Honor, I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with Neff. I apologize.
I'll leave it there. I don't want to use up your rebuttal time.
Maybe
you can think about it a little bit.
Maybe I can address it during my rebuttal if I could have the moment. But I didn't know if there were any other questions before I sit down initially.
Okay. Thank you. We have a lot of questions. I'll give you a little extra rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Ms. Tyson.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth.
Ms. Tyson, I'll spin the facts a little bit, take it in the land of what ifs, and ask you a question about that. If you were to assume that there's no grounds for a Terry stop, and I know the Commonwealth does not concede that, but
right.
If you just assume for the sake of the question that there are not sufficient grounds for the Terry stop and frisk, and then you take it further in the land of what-ifs and assume that when they started that frisk that the defendant did not resist and did not get aggressive with the police and strike the police as he did. They find the fish sandwich but decide that they're going to continue the further search on. Commonwealth's got a loser on their hands, don't they?
That is correct.
So is it the act of aggression at the time he is seized, arguably at the most, that changes things, changes the complexion completely?
Yes, it does. And again, and we don't concede, as you noted, but under your hypothetical, everything that has happened up until the point where the officer goes to reach toward the pocket, and I think that's really, really important on the Appendix 34 and 62, the action that was happening at the time of the first assault, and I guess I disagree with opposing counsel that first pushing away, there's a battery there, that is a crime. when he pushed the hand away initially, before he elbowed him in the face and knocked the camera down. So at that point, what is happening is the officer is going to touch the pocket. And at that point, there is a new and distinct crime. And because there is a new and distinct crime, there is a basis for the search incident to the arrest. The cocaine that's found in the second pair of pants is admissible because of the attenuation from the initial, in your hypothetical, misconduct from the police.
Is it your position that the police had sufficient reasonable suspicion to conduct the pat-down in the first instance?
I think it's a very close question, but I think they do under Andrews, and that's the case we relied on.
What crime in progress do they have suspicion might be occurring?
Your Honor, at the point that they were going to touch the pocket, the concern is that there is a concealed firearm.
But it's not unlawful to carry a concealed firearm in Virginia. You have a permit to do that. You have to have reasonable suspicion that a person is armed and dangerous, and reasonable suspicion that he's involved in the commission of a crime in order to justify a pat-down.
Yes, sir. But you don't have to have a probable cause. You have to have reasonable suspicion. If there's a concealed firearm, and of course I'm happy to continue down this line. I think the narrowest and best grounds for this court to determine this case is based on the attenuation doctrine. And these more difficult questions do not have to be answered because of what happened in this case. And I think it's precisely because the defendant decided that he was going to assault the officer, that he was going to obstruct justice, that the cocaine was found. And so that is the basis on which we would urge this court to affirm. And I do disagree that the defendant in this case was not belligerent. And, you know, it's difficult because now that we have these videos, we don't want the appellate court to be making the factual findings, but it's the evidence, and there it is. And you watch the video, and the defendant tells the police he doesn't have to give them half a clue of what's in his pocket. And perhaps the best part of the video, however, is that there is no menacing tone from these two young officers. If there's ever a conversational tone from police officers, it's on that videotape.
That's true, but they do tell him they're not leaving.
They are not leaving, that's right.
So it's pretty clear at that point he's seized, isn't it?
No, he is not seized at that point because he has not submitted, Your Honor. He hasn't submitted to what they've asked him to do, and they haven't touched him. So under Hodari D and everything after that, he has not been seized until...
There's a Terry stop, but not a seizure.
I believe that the Terry stop is when the officers place hands on him and not before, because he hasn't submitted to any authority from them. Quite the contrary. He is not going to submit to any authority. He's not answering any questions, and he's not standing up.
I guess the crux of this case, as I see it, is I'm going to assume for purposes of this question that the police did not have reasonable suspicion to conduct the pat-down. The question is, does the right to resist an unlawful arrest obviate or dispel somehow the existence of probable cause? I mean, how do those two concepts interplay?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that a right to resist an unlawful arrest does not dissipate the probable cause for the arrest. But I do think that in this case, this was not resisting an arrest. At most, even if the touching of the pocket occurred before the first assault by the defendant, it was a seizure. And under Commonwealth versus Hill and the couple of unpublished cases we cited from this court, you cannot resist a seizure, an unlawful seizure. You don't have the right to do that. The court hasn't recognized that. You have the right to resist the unlawful arrest. And so that defense...
recognized in Discali that the right to resist an unlawful arrest while alive in Virginia is on life support given the dire... consequences that can occur with street justice.
Your Honor, I read Discali. I can't recall the facts.
Okay.
With regard to attenuation, which is the basis on which we would urge this court to find that the evidence was admissible. I think that the
Sprint... search that's going to be conducted incident to a lawful arrest.
It is. It is, Your Honor. And in fact, the trial judge, who made alternative findings, of course, made the comment, once he assaulted the officer, he was going downtown. He was going to be arrested for that crime. And it almost smacks of inevitable discovery, but it doesn't quite meet the requirements for that. But it does meet attenuation. And attenuation, just like independent source and inevitable discovery, are exceptions to the exclusionary rule. And the argument from the defense that, well, his actions of his assault was in response to what the officers did, you find that in many, many of these attenuation cases. In Sprinkle from the Fourth Circuit, which, of course, is sort of the grandfather of some of these cases, the officers unquestionably, the court found, this was an unlawful seizure when the defendant got out of the car. But his response to that was to flee and then shoot at them. It was directly in response to their unlawful seizure. And yet that new and distinct crime...
So let me just see if I understand your argument, that there was no seizure because he had not submitted. There was a seizure once they touched him.
Yes.
But at that point, he resisted. And that the only way that this should perhaps be excluded and suppressed is if once they touched him, he just stood there and let them do whatever they were going to do, the touching of the pocket or anything else. At that point, then it should have been suppressed.
But for his new and distinct crime, there would not be attenuation. And if we assume that there's no reasonable suspicion, then the evidence would be suppressed. But that's not what we have. And I want to just make one other point.
I just follow up on one other point then? Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, and you've got two officers in a marked car, I don't know if the light is flashing or not, but it's clearly a situation where they don't even ask if they do a pat-down. They do ask to touch his pocket, so perhaps it's implied, but... I guess what I'm trying to get at is the officers don't appear to feel threatened, and they have certainly no more than a hunch at best that there's any criminal activity afoot here. So basically, what any of us, if we're in that situation on a street corner, just ready to eat our fish sandwich and having a candle by us because of a memorial service that happened somewhere, we just need to just sit there. Even if there are five officers with the lights flashing and all sorts of indication that we can't go anywhere or do anything.
We need to make the decision not to assault the officer.
Because unless there's an actual arrest and they say you are under arrest, that's the only point that under Virginia, even at common law in Virginia, one could resist.
If the circumstantial evidence, even the words were not spoken, if the level of detention rose to the level of arrest, then that would be a different, then there would be the argument about resisting arrest. But that's not what we had here. But it was more than resisting. It was the actual new and distinct crime against the officer. And just like in, I guess Boykins is the case that comes to mind, which occurred fairly recently from this court, where the officer actually tased the defendant, and the court found, assuming that was improper, that the stop and the tasing was improper, the fact of the matter was that defendant obstructed justice, and the search incident to arrest of obstruction of justice is where the evidence was found, and it was admissible. So if we want to look at the standards or the prongs of the test that Strieff and some other cases have posited, the proximity goes against the government in almost all of these cases because it's almost always very close in time. So we look at the other two. One is the intervening circumstance. Well, the intervening circumstance here is very clear. It is the assault by the defendant on the officers, the obstructionist activity that he determines. He makes the decision that he's going to assault and obstruct. And then the last factor is the purpose and flagrancy of the police misconduct. And here is where I also disagree with my opposing counsel. Because perhaps they were wrong, perhaps they made a mistake. Their concern, as indicated in the record, is that there was a firearm in that pocket. They were concerned that that heavy item in the kangaroo pocket was a firearm at Appendix 31 and 61, and they wanted to investigate that. And whether they were correct in how they went about it, whether they had necessary levels, this was not flagrant behavior by the police.
The flagrancy here, and it's absolutely the reason for the suppression rule, is because police have to learn to take no for an answer. And that doesn't seem to be what happened here. He clearly said, no, you may not search me. And the police were going to do that no matter what. I can't for the life of me figure out what criminal activity was going on lighting a candle on a public street.
But if we look at is the flagrancy, the behavior of the police officers, then no, you can't say that this was flagrant. Strieff was the situation where the officer saw the fellow going into the house and then he stopped him. And of course, the facts are different because there was an outstanding warrant in that case. But he was conducting a legitimate investigation. And the concern that these young officers testified to in this case...
Investigation of what?
Was that they were concerned when they saw that bulge in this high crime
neighborhood. Can a police officer search anybody that has a bulge in their pocket because they think they might have a gun in it?
No, Your Honor, I think the case law is pretty clear that a bulge alone is not enough, but we had more than that in this case. It was during the nighttime, it was in a high drug area, and then irrespective of whether the defendant in this case was belligerent or polite or whatever, he wasn't in agreement. He wasn't helpful. He wasn't cooperating.
It's not illegal to carry a gun in the city of Richmond, even in a high drug area. I mean, I'm sure there's quite a few people with permits walking around all over that area.
And Your Honor, if in fact the officers had to have that level of suspicion that they could sustain a conviction, then that would be different. But we're talking about a reasonable suspicion.
So your argument is that anybody with a bulge in their pocket in a high crime area in the city of Richmond is subject to being stopped and frisked.
That is not my argument.
Well, that's just what I think. That's just what you said.
No, Your Honor, I think that what I said was that given the circumstances here, the totality, and I know that's a buzzword that gets thrown around, but if you look at everything,
weird behaviors.
But on the other point I'd like to make is...
The totality in numerous cases, including my Irvin case, I've talked about the totality of the circumstances, each mounting upon the other. I see no totality here.
And, Your Honor, and we would be in such a different position, I would say, if we did not have the new and distinct crime that led to a proper search incident where they found the 26 baggies of cocaine in that second pair of pants because he was arrested for assault and obstruction. And the cases that have recently been decided, including Strieff, including Boykins from this court, would indicate and support the position that the attenuation doctrine applies here and that the evidence was admissible. The trial court did not err. We would urge this court to affirm.
So without attenuation, Commonwealth loses.
We have a difficult time, and a very difficult time, but we do have attenuation, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. Ms. Whitley, I'll give you your full 3 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Let me rephrase my question a little bit. So perhaps even if the court granted the motion to suppress, that would not prevent the Commonwealth from going forward on the obstruction of justice.
That's correct. Case.
So the obstruction of justice case has nothing to do really with the motion to suppress.
Well, I think as far as it's wrapped up in part and parcel to what was argued and where we're at on appeal, we're not going to concede
that that conviction would stand. I'd also just note for the court, there was a plea of no contest, so there wasn't actually a guilty plea that was entered, which I think is significant. But you're correct. The Commonwealth could go forward on an assault on a police officer or obstruction charge. And I think that's what's dangerous about the Commonwealth's position.
There's no difference between the NOAA contender plea and a guilty plea as far as the conditional aspect of it for the motion to suppress.
Not at the end of the day, no, sir. But I think what the Commonwealth is really asking this court is to establish a bright-line rule that any time there is a new offense committed in response to unconstitutional government conduct, that that is a salve for all of that conduct. And that's a dangerous request before this court. As a hypothetical, I point out, if someone was in their home and the police bust in and shoot at that person's child or themselves, and that person shoots back and is arrested for capital murder or attempted capital murder, and drugs are found on that person as a search incident to arrest, this court and the Supreme Court has said still has to engage as far as that drugs go in that analysis of whether there was a significant and sufficient new and intervening circumstance for the arrest. The arrest itself does not solve the government conduct. And I think that is what this court is required to do. I would point the court, it's an unpublished case, but I think it is still good law, even despite Utah versus Streif, which is Augustus, Commonwealth against Augustus.
It's a completely different factual
situation. It is a very different factual situation.
Augustus didn't engage in any assaultive behavior. He just sat in his truck and refused to comply.
That's true.
That's a very different
case. Well, Your Honor, I think that the court, though, in Augustus did engage appropriately in that attenuation doctrine analysis, looking at the circumstances and facts presented. It was not the arrest happened, so therefore anything found search incident to arrest comes in. And that's my point in raising Augustus.
And also the secondary crime hadn't been litigated at that point.
That's true. However, I think that analysis that the court engaged in Augustus is appropriate here as well. It cannot be just because there is an arrest for a new crime that all evidence of an ongoing crime is admitted.
I don't think that's the Commonwealth's position here, though.
That's my understanding of what she's asking this court to do as far as the bright line rule. Maybe I misunderstand, but I think that that is one of the dangers of what this case presents. And I would also highlight to this court, in Boykins, there was not a challenge in any of the assignments, as I read that case, to the actual arrest. So I don't think that that case really presented the same issues before this court that this case does. We are challenging the arrest, certainly, and speaking about Mr. Dotson's right to defend himself in the course of that arrest. While that may not negate probable cause for assault on a police officer, it is a fact that this court must consider in looking at the nature of the new and intervening circumstance and the nature of the flagrancy of the conduct. And looking at that doctrine altogether, it is clear that the exclusionary rule should have applied. The two goals of the exclusionary rule are deterrence and public confidence in the system. This is the very case that would achieve those goals. So I would ask the court to reverse the trial court's error.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel, and then the next case on our docket is Lamar Shelton Brown versus Commonwealth.